It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to an Afghan writer about his experiences growing up during the many wars and transitions in his home country that his home country has seen in the past few decades.
But first, yesterday, the Washington Post and the Guardian's U.S. wing won the Pulitzer Prize for public service for their coverage of the National Security Agency's surveillance activities after last year's bombshell disclosures from former NSA contractor Edward Snowden.
There had been a lot of speculation over whether the Pulitzer would be awarded for the controversial stories of how the NSA had secretly collected millions of Americans' phone records and internet data. Michael Calderone joins us. He's the senior media reporter at the Huffington Post. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Michael, there was a lot of buzz in the past weeks about whether the Pulitzer Board would take this step, which many see as a courageous one, if not provocative. Just how surprising is this to you?
Well, you know, the NSA coverage and the reporters and news organizations involved with it have won a number of prestigious awards. Just this past Friday, Glenn Greenwald and others who were involved with the coverage from The Guardian and also from The Washington Post won the prestigious Polk Award. But there was still speculation about whether the Pulitzer Committee would honor them, because the Pulitzer Committee would be making quite a statement. And I think they did this in giving the award, especially for public service. They're making a statement that these disclosures were in the public interest, and this is what journalists and editors have been arguing all along, even as you have members of government and officials and some members of Congress suggesting otherwise, that these disclosures were not in the public interest and actually damaged national security.
For listeners who may not be so familiar with the story, would you mind recapping it for us?
Sure. I mean, the Guardian, which is a British newspaper, has a U.S. Newsroom as well. And it was actually, they broke the initial story in June of 2013. And at that time, we didn't know who Edward Snowden was. But the initial story was about Verizon and how the NSA had been sweeping up millions of Americans' phone records. And this is the first story broke. And then the second day, within 24 hours, the Washington Post and the Guardian had two more bombshell stories about how the NSA, the National Security Agency, was sweeping up internet data and was getting a direct line to a number of different major companies like Google and Yahoo. And, so this got the ball rolling, and it was a couple days later that The Guardian, through Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, who's a filmmaker, they helped Edward Snowden reveal himself to the world. And Edward Snowden, by this time, was in Hong Kong, and he revealed that he was the leaker of these documents. And Edward Snowden now remains in Moscow and has been charged with crimes under the Espionage Act here in the U.S. So, it started with a couple big stories, and it just snowballed. And the stories aren't over, because now you have the New York Times has some documents. Other outlets around the world have documents, and Glenn Greenwald, who is the journalist who was at The Guardian and has since left to help start his own media company, he's saying that some of the biggest, most complex stories are still to come.
Does this, the Pulitzer for this was given in the category of public service, and I'm wondering if that sends a message about the purpose, the mission of journalism and what it's meant to do. Does it send that message?
I think it does. The Public Service Award is a really significant one. I mean, in the past, NSA reporting has sometimes fallen under national reporting. For instance, the New York Times reported in 2005 on the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping program, and that was a bombshell story. And similar to the NSA disclosures more recently, got a lot of criticism, suggestions that the New York Times was acting as a traitor or had damaged national security. That went under national reporting. And so one of the questions leading into the Pulitzers was both, A, would the Pulitzer Committee honor the NSA coverage? And if they did, how would they do it? Would it be specific reporters? Would it be for a reporting category? Would it be for public service? So I think by giving it in public service and giving it to both The Guardian and The Washington Post, because they were really at the forefront of all this, I think it makes a real statement that this reporting and that this coverage and these revelations are truly in the public interest and have sparked a really important debate worldwide about privacy and surveillance.
Snowden himself declared it a vindication upon hearing the news of this award. And I'm wondering how this public debate over his actions have him declared both a hero and a traitor. How will this award affect his image in the public eye?
You know, I don't know. I think a lot of people are pretty set on how they see him. Like you said, people, you know, clearly think that he is a traitor for what he did. He leaked classified documents to journalists, and he left the country, and now he's in Russia, a country that clearly the U.S. is at odds with over a number of different issues. And so, you know, I don't think it's going to change those people's minds. And for people who see him as a hero and really feel that he, you know, what he did was beneficial, so that people would actually have a better understanding of the government's seizing of their data, you know, how the government takes their data and how the government uses it and or doesn't use it. I think those people will still see that he generated a truly important debate, and I'm reluctant to, I think maybe the Pulitzer could push some in the direction that what he did was good for society, but I think in a lot of ways people may have already have their minds made up.
Mm-hmm. Well, some would also say that the heroes in the story are the journalists themselves. Could you talk a little bit about what challenges and maybe even threats the journalists face when they're up against the story that they might feel obligated to report on, but also are being pressured not to?
Right. I mean, this is one of the most challenging stories in some time, just even from the initial contact with the source, Edward Snowden. He started trying to reach a couple journalists that he felt were really passionate advocates of civil liberties and really cared about the issues that he cared about. He started in January of 2013 trying to reach Glenn Greenwald, who was in with The Guardian, and Laura Poitras, who is a filmmaker, a freelance filmmaker, and who has done work on the NSA and has covered issues like war and surveillance. And so initially he had trouble even reaching Glenn Greenwald because Snowden would only communicate through encrypted communications, and that's something Glenn Greenwald didn't have set up in his computer. So even the initial contacts took a couple months to kind of get the ball rolling here back a little over a year ago. And then Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and the Washington bureau chief from The Guardian, Ewan McCaskill, then had to fly to Hong Kong to meet this source. They didn't know what he looked like. They didn't know if this was some sort of trap. They didn't know what the situation was going to be. And they met Snowden in Hong Kong, you know, got documents from him, and he, you know, revealed himself, and it became an international story overnight. And just in the reporting of this story, you have several journalists dispersed around the world. Glenn Greenwald lives in Rio de Janeiro. Laura Poitras is based in Berlin. The Guardian, which is where Greenwald was working, is based primarily in the UK, but also has a large newsroom now in New York City as well. And so there was a lot of moving parts here in terms of journalists trying to report out this story from several different countries at one time. And probably the biggest threat was not in the U.S., but in the U.K. The U.K. doesn't have the same sort of precedent for guaranteeing a free press that we have here in the U.S., and the U.K. authorities really cracked down on The Guardian in London, and at one point in time even compelled their editors to break their hard drive, to smash the computer hard drives that had the Snowden documents. Now, I mean, it was sort of a symbolic moment in this whole story because the documents were now dispersed around the world, and, you know, the documents aren't physically on a computer. They're, you know, uploaded and able to be accessed in all sorts of other ways. So, you know, it was a pretty incredible story because it brought to mind the Pentagon paper story in the U.S. during the Vietnam War, and you know, where a government tried to suppress the ongoing publication of state secrets. And, you know, it's as much as it's a national security story, it's also a journalism and a media story.
Mm-hmm. How do you think this will change the public demand for this type of journalism, these exposés or a challenge against government operation and surveillance?
Well, it's, you know, it's been a tough time because even outside of the Snowden documents, the Obama administration has been especially tough on leaks. They've cracked down more on leaks than any recent administration in terms of invoking the Espionage Act, which they used against Edward Snowden, and they've used more than all other U.S. presidential administrations combined. So, I mean, there is this climate where journalists will say that there's a chill in investigative reporting, but you see that there still is a hunger to get this type of information out there right now with the CIA's the CIA torture report, which is currently is being redacted, and some small part of it, maybe 10% of it, may actually be see the light of day. You have McClatchy, for instance, just last week, the Senate Intelligence Committee saying that they wanted to investigate a leak that went to McClatchy to reveal what was in this major study about the use of sort of what some call enhanced interrogation techniques, or some see as torture, mm-hmm. during the Bush years. So, you know, there are a lot of documents in there that journalists think are in the public interest and should see the light of day, and you know, and hopefully we'll see some more leaks, not reckless leaks, but leaks from people who feel that certain information should be out there and shouldn't be kept under lock and key.
Sure. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
That was Michael Calderon, senior media reporter at The Huffington Post. It's been more than a decade since the United States began fighting in Afghanistan in 2001. If all goes according to plan, the U.S. mission in the country will be over by the end of the year, making it America's longest war.
Now is a crucial time for Afghanistan. Earlier this month, 7 million Afghans headed to the polls in what marked the country's first democratic transfer of presidential power. 59% of the electorate made it to the polls despite threats and violence from the Taliban. Results now show close results with the likely runoff.
During the past three decades, Afghanistan has become a country used to transitions from the Soviet invasion in 1979 to the rise of the Taliban to the American and NATO invasion.
Qais Akbar Omar tells the story of Afghanistan's turmoil from a personal angle in his memoir, A Fort of Nine Towers, an Afghan family story. His popular memoir was released earlier this month in paperback. Qais, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So the story of your family has a lot in common with the story of Afghanistan itself. What are some of the regime changes that you've lived through?
Well, in the West, mostly people know about the Taliban, and they don't know much about what Afghanistan went through before the Taliban came to power, which we had 4.5 years of civil war. And during that time, it's hard to get accurate number, but the number we get is like 2.6 million people were killed, innocent people, at that time. And my book is pretty much talks about that time. And I wrote the whole book written from the point of view of a child, how he sees things and how his world shifts. And pretty much two-thirds of the book is focused on that time, and then the arrival of the Taliban, and then the American. Basically, it's a story of one family, how to survive during those 4.5 years.
And your story begins in an Afghanistan that sounds at odds with the country that we see on the news today in America. It was a place that was full of beauty. Can you describe that Afghanistan of your childhood?
Yeah, well, Afghanistan is not always like what you have today. Normally, I mean, now at the moment, as soon as you hear the word Afghanistan, people think of the bloodshed, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, all of those horrible and negative things happening there. But before that, Afghanistan was a very, very nice and beautiful place. I remember when my mother went to bank, and she used to wear short skirts, and my father he was a boxer, and he used to wear bell-bottom trousers, and he had sideburns, and the streets were full of trees, and they made arch, and on both sides, and schools were so good, and people were so nice and educated. And the problem is, war has always been thrust on Afghanistan. At the moment, people think that Afghans probably are the warriors, but they are not. They are just people of culture and custom. And I remember that my uncle and aunts used to sit, we all sit around a candle at night. We'll turn off the TV and the lights, and we recite poetry, and it will last from 1 hour to several hours. I recite, for example, two verses from Rumi, and my aunt or my uncle would recite to fight me back with two verses by Omar Khayyam or Hafez or Saadi, and this would go on for 3-4 hours, and the storytelling, another thing. And we all used to live in a one big, nice courtyard, which 50, 60 people all sat around one tablecloth, and every night was like a party.
And you describe a family life that was prosperous and happy. When did you finally realize that it wasn't safe and you had to find refuge somewhere outside of the family home?
Yeah, well, you know, when the Russian came in Afghanistan in 1979, at the time, Kabul was, I was not even born. I was born 3 years later. And even when I was 4 or 5 years old, Kabul was relatively peaceful because the Russian kept Kabul very calm. And they built roads and they built nice buildings all over the place. And but out in the countryside, if they found one person opposing to them, they will just go and bomb the whole village and kill thousands of people. And as a result, a large number of Afghans migrated to Pakistan and Iran, where they were farmed. And some factions were formed in Pakistan by Americans, and they came and fought the Russians. And so when the Russians were defeated, these seven factions, when they came, my grandfather was very, very hopeful that now Afghanistan is in the hands of our own people and they will do a good job. So when these people came for the 6-7 months, Kabul was very nice and peaceful and people could travel anywhere in the country, no problem. And after 5-6 months, since these people did not have any experience of how to run the country, each faction wanted to be the next president or the next prime minister or minister of defense. And then they had so much money and weapon already from Americans and some other countries, they start fighting each other. And as a result, we had 4.5 years of civil war. So, and at the time, I was 9 years old when civil war happened. And slowly, that beautiful world before our eyes just changed into hell. And from then on, we didn't see a single day of happiness. We had to leave our house, Kabul, to cross the border to go to Uzbekistan or Tajikistan, and from there to Italy. That was the plan. So everywhere we went, civil war chased us, and to a point that we had to go and live in the head of the Buddha in Bamiyan Valley, in the central Afghanistan, where the statues of Buddha that were exploded by the Taliban. We lived there in the cave for 2 months.
And you had so many experiences. It's an incredible story. I want to fast forward a little and get us up to date on what's happening now. As we mentioned, Afghanistan is again in transition with its first democratic transfer of power and the end of the United States war there. What are your biggest concerns and your hopes for your country now?
Well, my hope is that everybody was saying that, oh, the Taliban is going to disrupt the election and they're not going to let this happen. Great success. That's all I can say now. And I'm saying that with a lot of pride. My family, my friends, my countrymen, everybody went to the polling centers and voted. And it was a great day, that election day, that Taliban warned that they are going to bomb every polling center. And they couldn't do a single thing. So everybody, a large number of people went and voted. And even those people who couldn't, who didn't vote or didn't have cards to go and vote, they went out and dipped their finger, their index finger, into the bottles of ink and went around and pointed their fingers at that, oh, we voted. So it was like a celebration, a very, very great day. So people were very happy, and as a result, there's a great hope that we will have the next president and who will be a better person. But at the same time, the big concern is that the Taliban are still there. So you have to just you have to be hopeful, but at the same time, you have to understand the reality. The seven factions who caused 4.5 years of civil war, they are still running the country, and all these groups. And then you have the local warlords, and then you have the drug lords, and then you have those kidnapping groups and gangsters, all of those people. They have more money and weapons than ever. And as soon as Americans, they were talking for a while about the zero option, which was not a very good idea, because as soon as they pull out, history will be repeated in Afghanistan, exactly what happened when the Russians pull out of Afghanistan.
And I'm afraid we have to leave it there. We're out of time. Qais, thank you so much for joining us today. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Qais Akbar Omar about Afghanistan's history as it makes its first democratic transition of presidential power. His memoir is called A Fort of Nine Towers, and it came out earlier this month in paperback.
Some recent court cases have raised the question, should pets have the same legal rights as people? Some animal advocates are happy about the legal trend, but others, including some veterinarians and small business owners, are pushing back. Today, cats and dogs are the most legally protected animals in the United States.
David Grimm joins us now. He's a deputy news editor at Science and the author of the new book, Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you tell a story that gets at the trend of pets being given legal rights that are more like a person's legal rights. Could you tell us the story about the dog Ruthie, who was hit by a car, and what happened?
Well, this was a dog that was hit by a car a couple of years ago, and what happened was that the owner had left to go shopping, she had a maid service come in. The maid service came in. The dog escaped from the house. And the dog was hit by a car. The dog was killed. When the owner returned home, she found the dog dead, I believe, under her dining room table. And she sued not only for her emotional distress, but for the emotional distress of her daughter. I think she sued for about $100,000. She ended up recovering about $65,000. And the dog had been purchased for less than $300.
So what does this signify to you, that she was able to get almost, you know, her entire sum, $65,000, for the loss of a dog?
Well, I think it really shows that how far cats and dogs have come in the eyes of the law. Just a century ago, cats and dogs were considered so legally worthless, they didn't even qualify as property. If somebody killed your dog or took your dog, you couldn't do anything because they weren't legal property. It was basically as if you had not broken the law at all. Of course, that's changed. Dogs and cats are now property in the United States. They're, in fact, the most valued animal property that we have. But some courts are starting to treat them not so much like property. A lot of us, in fact, most of us see our cats and dogs as family members, and you're starting to see that trend in courts as well as in this case, where if the judge was just treating this dog like a piece of property, they would probably give the woman $300 because that's what she paid for her dog. But by granting these emotional distress damages that are in the tens of thousands of dollars, they're really acknowledging that this isn't just a piece of property like a toaster or a couch, but they're really acknowledging this familial relationship that we have with our pets.
So how big a trend is this, that pets are being seen by some courts as having rights more like people's?
It's hit or miss. There's definitely been a lot more cases like this in the last 20 years than there have ever been before. There have been veterinary malpractice cases that have been awarded for tens of thousands of dollars. You're seeing custody cases over cats and dogs where a judge will decide what's in the best interest of the cat, where will the dog be happiest, which you would never do for a couch or a table, but you're seeing judges do that for cats and dogs. We also have every state in the country has a felony anti-cruelty law that covers cats and dogs. So if you abuse a cat or a dog, you can be, in some states, fined up to $125,000 and put in jail for up to 10 years. So it is becoming more prevalent, the protections and some might say the rights that we're giving these animals, but that doesn't mean by any stretch of the imagination that you're guaranteed, especially in a case like Ruthie's case, that you're going to get a settlement like that. That is happening more, but it's still not happening all the time.
You write about a case that's to the contrary in Texas, where it was pretty much the opposite sort of scenario. Can you tell us about that?
Exactly. Yeah, there was a case in Texas also a few years ago, and this was a case where a dog got lost, a family dog got lost, got picked up by a shelter. The shelter accidentally euthanized the dog instead of waiting for the owners to come pick it up. And then what happened was that the owners sued just for the sentimental value of the dog. So they sued, I can't remember for how much, it was probably a few thousand dollars, saying, even though this dog, we may have bought this dog for, a few hundred dollars, but this dog was like a family member. And in Texas, for sentimental value, you can get that award if somebody comes and destroys your grandmother's wedding dress or they destroy a photo album. You can actually recover sentimental damages beyond the market value. But when this case went to the Texas Supreme Court, you had groups like the American Veterinary Medical Association filing briefs that basically said, do not award sentimental damages for the death of this dog. If you do that, it's going to be a very slippery slope where we're going to start to have a flooding of the courts with malpractice suits and more suits like we saw in the Ruthie's case. And that's exactly what the Texas Supreme Court did. They denied that claim. And now, as the law stands in Texas, you can actually recover more if somebody destroys a picture of your dog than if they destroy the dog itself. So it's definitely gone both ways.
So this has been by no means sort of been decided in the court of public opinion or in the court of law. You hear a lot about, you know, people talking about their pets as their fur babies, as their children,
right.
All of these different things. There are pet spas now. Is that sort of what's behind the drive to see pets more like family members, like people?
Exactly. And I think the trend definitely started in the home. We've long considered cats and dogs pets, but it's really only been in the last couple of decades that we've really started to treat them and view them in a very broad, socially acceptable way as family members. In fact, more than 80% of owners refer to themselves as their cat or dog's mom or dad. More than 80% would be somewhat or very likely to risk their lives to save their pet. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite stats is more than 50% of owners, if they had to live out their days on a desert island, would rather live out their days with their pet than with a human companion. So, you know, we've really come quite a ways in viewing these animals, not just as pets or even companions, but as family members. And I think what you're seeing in the courts and even in legislatures is that politicians and judges have started to catch on, and probably because they have pets themselves that they treat like family members, and they're maybe no longer comfortable with laws or rulings that treat these animals like a toaster.
Well, it's an interesting thing because the United States is far from being the most protective of animals. If you look at some of the laws in the EU protecting animals, you know, looking at more like the great apes, for instance, there are more protections afforded there. But here, it's pets that seem like they're getting the most legal protection. How do you account for the difference?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think that it's definitely different in different countries. I think in most Western countries, or at least in a lot of the Western countries in the developed world, you do see a lot of protections for cats and dogs that you don't necessarily see for other animals. It's interesting because the groups in the United States that are pushing for more rights for pets are also pushing for more rights for chimpanzees and other animals, but they've had a lot more success with cats and dogs. And I think that's not terribly surprising considering the relationship that we have with our pets, that we don't necessarily, even though I think a lot of us appreciate that elephants and chimpanzees and other animals like that are very intelligent and worth protecting and saving, I think we just don't have the emotional bond with those animals like we do with our pets. And I think that's especially why you're seeing in places like the United States so many laws that protect pets that don't necessarily protect other animals.
It is interesting looking at the post-Katrina landscape, Hurricane Katrina, when there were so many animals that ended up in shelters and needed to be adopted. I remember Anderson Cooper talked a lot about the dogs there.
Right.
And things changed because of that.
Exactly. Well, one survey suggested that 44% of the people that didn't evacuate during Katrina didn't evacuate because their pets. They would have rescuers come to their houses in boats and helicopters, and the rescuers would say, "We can't take your cat or your dog." And the people would say, "Well, then I'm staying behind. They're a member of my family, and I'm not going to leave my family behind." And unfortunately, a lot of those people died. So a lot of the people that died in Katrina died because they stayed behind for their pets. And I think in the aftermath of Katrina, politicians really wised up to that idea. There was a federal law passed in the United States in 2006 called the Pets Act, which basically impels rescue agencies to save pets as well as people. It really recommends that you can't just go in there and save people, because if people are going to stay behind because of their cats and dogs, you need to save their cats and dogs too.
We're talking right now with David Grimm. He's the author of Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs, about the trend to extend pets the rights of people. And we want to know what you think about this. Are cats and dogs like people? Does the personal anguish that some people feel when their pets die make the pets more like family members than animals? And is this a trend that could slow down animal research and leave vets and businesses vulnerable to lawsuits?
You can let us know what you think by joining the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're back now with David Grimm, the author of Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs, about the trend to extend pets the rights of people.
What do you think? Should pets have personhood? Are they more like family to you than animals? If you were forced to make a decision in an emergency, whether to leave your pet behind or to stay with them, what would you do? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's go now to the phones and talk to Kathleen in Delafield. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Thank you for letting me voice my opinion. I just lost my little buddy, my dog of 7 years.
I'm sorry.
And me too.
Yeah.
But the thing is we're finding out more and more about animals than we, you know, gave them credit for years ago. And they are a very integral part of the family. So it's important to not just, you know, push them off as, well, it's just a dog, as some people think. It's almost, the loss is like a child. So I just wanted to let people know.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kathleen, for calling and sharing your experience. Again, sorry for your loss. And David, there's a pet owner saying that her dog was like, it was like losing a child. Is that typical of what you hear?
Yeah, I think it is very typical. I think it used to be that, you know, when somebody would say something like that, or somebody would say, you know, I just spent a couple $1,000 on chemotherapy for my cat, you know, the society would sort of view them as the crazy dog person or the crazy cat lady. I don't think that's where we are anymore. I think that it's, you know, just based on the statistics I just gave you a couple minutes ago, I think it's broadly socially acceptable now to really view these animals as members of the family, to have funerals for them, to leave money for them in our wills, to try to get them rescued in natural disasters. So I think we've really moved way beyond the crazy cat lady, the crazy dog person. This is really where society is right now.
And let's go back to the phones. We've got Mike with us in Kenosha. Hey, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that you know, I'm an animal lover. I grew up on a farm, and I at one point in time we had four dogs and a bunch of cats, and I love animals. But I think it's great that people get tied in with their pets to a degree that they do. But we already fail in so many ways to meet the needs of the human members of our community, that any diversion of resources that we've got that politically are available to pay for advancing human society really should be limited to paying for that, and not diverted to pay for the protection of animals. That without recognizing our responsibility to our fellow citizens, even if it is the emotional need of those fellow citizens to save their pet, that we're making choices each time, and those choices include things like not paying for educational opportunities for small children, not paying for health care for small children, not paying for elder care, not protecting the elderly from victimization. I mean, we're making those choices every time we spend money on something else.
All right. Thanks a lot for your thoughts, Mike. And what about that perspective, David? Putting people first, we're clearly not serving all the people in our society. We can't take care of everyone, so that is where the priorities should go.
I mean, I think it's a valid concern, and you hear that a lot, that, you know, oh my gosh, we're prioritizing animals above people. I guess what people on the other side would say to that is that, you know, these animals really have become part of our society, so it's not just like, let's spend money on our society and not spend money on these animals. These animals really are part of our society. You know, the woman that just called, this is like her child, you know, and there are studies that have shown that cats and dogs are very important for our health, that they can lower blood pressure. There are cats and dogs going into nursing homes now and helping alleviate symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. We have more than 2,000 dogs serving in the U.S. military, and I think that General David Petraeus said they were one of the most valuable assets the military has ever had. So I think it would be, you know, I think we have to be careful about saying, well, you know, passing these animals off as just sort of trivial things, which I don't think the caller was doing at all. But I do think that they've become so ingrained in our society that I don't think that spending money on them or protecting them is necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think a lot of this comes back to help us as humans in the end.
And we can hear from more of you right now, 800-642-1234. Curious if you would sue over an accident, maybe like the one we heard about where a cleaning company let your pet out. They were hit by a car. Would you sue? Would you consider that something that would be within your rights? Would you consider that pet that was killed a member of your family? And what about rescuers? Should they be as concerned about pets? Should there be a place for pets within that rescue boat, that rescue plane, along with the people? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll go next to Susie, who's joining us in Toma. Hi, Susie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. It's so funny that you should be talking about dogs, because we just took our dog to a doggy resort because he's going on vacation and we're going to be gone for a few days, and I will tell you, it's very difficult to get into this doggy resort. You have to look at a month to 6 weeks ahead of time to reserve your room, because it's a very popular place to go. But I agree with, if something happened to our dog that with the negligence of a housekeeper or something like that, that we, our family would be extremely upset, and that we would probably look at a negligence and a suing. And we've discussed about what would happen if we needed to be rescued, that we wouldn't leave our dog. We just wouldn't leave him. He's brought so much joy and pleasure to my home and to our neighborhood that it would be a tragedy if something happened to him that wasn't prevented. We have also included him in our trust. Our children are growing up, and they have their own families and their own pets. And I shouldn't say it this way. I don't care to have our dog, so we have him in our trust. That we have arranged with the puppy resort to take him as either a permanent resident or to find some loving human for him. And this isn't unusual. This is very, very common. So, you know, animals are very important to many, many people. They don't substitute for our children or our grandchildren, but they're just a joy and a pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Susie, for calling up and telling us about what you've done for your dog. And really, a lot of thought put into Susie's dog. They have a nice experience for their dog when they go on vacation, and they've accounted for a place for their dog to go in their will as well. And that really sounds like the face of our evolving feelings about cats and dogs.
Exactly. And, you know, this idea of being able to leave money to your animals has become legally enforceable now. Before 2000, if you left money to an animal in a trust or a will, a judge could void it, especially if a relative contested it. Now it's the law in most states that you can leave money to your animals, and even there's the potential for, if somebody contests that, the judge may even appoint a lawyer for that animal. So you could have a lawyer representing a dog or a cat in a courtroom fighting for their share of the will. And, you know, some people might sort of see that as ridiculous, but it's getting back to the owners, like the caller that just called, and just saying, you know, this pet is a member of the family. I want to make sure that if something happens to us, this pet's going to be taken care of, that he or she is not going to end up in a shelter or on the street. So it really gets back to reinforcing this bond and finding ways to support and honor this bond that we have with these animals.
David, what is the next frontier of this? If we're seeing this trend right now of the courts increasingly looking at pets as having more rights, more akin to people, what comes next? What's the next step?
Well, I think we're at this really interesting turning point, because some groups and some people are definitely pushing for more rights for these animals, for them to be able to do even more in the legal system than they can now, to make them even more like children or even like people in a court of a law. But you have a lot of groups fighting back, the American Veterinary Medical Association, research organizations, farm organizations that are really worried about the impact on small businesses. Veterinarians are worried about getting slapped with $10,000 or more malpractice suits, which has already happened. Biomedical researchers worry that if we start viewing cats and dogs like children today, what's to stop us from viewing lab rats like people tomorrow? And farmers obviously concerned the same could happen to cows. So you're seeing a backlash against this movement as well. And it's really going to be interesting to see how this all plays out over the next couple of decades, whether we are content to leave our cats and dogs kind of in this pet property status, or if we want to take the chance and try to move them beyond that.
And we'll go back to our phone lines. Now we've got Peggy joining us in Ironwood, Michigan. Hey, Peggy.
Hi. Yeah, I have a small boarding facility, and I do grooming there also. And I also breed on a pretty low-key basis Labrador Retrievers. This concerns me, you know, because of my businesses and the liability. And I keep my facility small so that I can do all the work myself as it is, because it's so hard to trust other people with the care of other people's dogs. And, you know, I don't take cats, but, you know, it just makes me think, well, what's going to happen? You know, I have high risk clients that are elderly dogs and dogs with chronic condition like diabetes. And, you know, what happens if they pass away while they're with me and the owner decides that I was negligent in some way? And, you know, I know of other boarding kennels that have, you know, had dogs escape and, you know, be killed. And, you know, it's just an awful thing. No one wants that kind of thing. But these are animals. They're in a high stress situation. You know, a lot of boarding kennels have to take a lot of dogs because that's how they can make enough money to support their business. I'm fortunate where I'm at home and I can do it on a very small scale.
Peggy, is this something that you're worried about could, you know, potentially shut your business down?
Yes. That you know, because of the small scale, the way that I work, I can't afford huge insurance premiums, you know, to protect our property and, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, fortunately, I haven't had things like this happen, but these are animals.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Peggy. And another perspective there, this is sort of the thing that you've written about, David, that some people concerned that it could affect their livelihood, that maybe it's going too far.
Exactly. People really worried about getting hit with these multi-$10,000, $100,000 judgments in courts because the owners are treating their cats and dogs like proper and like people in the courtroom. And so that's why you have definitely seen this backlash from not just the veterinary community, but small businesses, groomers, dog walkers, just terrified that, you know, that they're going to be put out of business if something happens to an animal in their care.
And we're going to have to leave it there. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it.
We've been talking to David Grimm, a deputy news editor at Science and the author of the book Citizen Canine.